Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Ages ago, in the mists of history, we had the great Robert Falster on the podcast. Do you remember that, everybody?
Yeah.
From The Go-Betweens.
The Go-Betweens, yeah.
And he'd written a really good
book.
His
Rock and Roll Rules.
He'd written a really good book called The 10 Rules of Rock and Roll, which is very good. Things like, you know, you never get any new information as a rock and roll show after the third number.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. If a guitarist plays more than one guitar, he's just showing off his guitar collection and all that stuff. And I thought of an 11th rule of rock and roll. I thought of it this afternoon while being at Alex's sound check with Piney Gear down at the Islington immediately before this. And this is the 11th rule of rock and roll. And it goes like this. Sound checks always expand to fill the time available for them. It's true, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's a form of showing off, isn't it? You're showing off to the barmaid and the promoter. And trying out the new song that the rest of the band don't like. And it's
if a band has 5 minutes to soundcheck, they soundcheck in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
If a band has 5 hours, they soundcheck in 5 and a half, don't they? Is that true, Alex?
And the majority of support bands soundcheck during their first number because they haven't been allowed to soundcheck.
Yes, that's very true.
By the Stranglers, whoever it is.
Well, soundcheck's actually quite unique in that they defy the laws of modern conventional chronology. They exist in a time spectrum all of their own. So if you need half an hour, you will probably take an hour and a half by some dint of
how
the
drummer. How long does your ukulele orchestra take to soundcheck then?
Well,
8 instruments, 9 instruments?
Actually, no, it's very rigid in the orchestra because the guy who runs it, he's a very rigid guy, and he tells us off if we go over. We do 2 numbers and that's it. The same numbers every night. Bang, bang, done.
Off. Which are the 2 numbers you do?
We do Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys.
Oh, lovely.
And we'll do the opening instrumental as well. So this year it was, what was it? It was Hall of the Mountain King.
Oh, by Grieg.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a classic tune. That's a monster tune.
So bring everybody up today, Alex.
Yeah.
You've joined a ukulele orchestra about, what, 18 months ago? They rang you up, said, "Do you play the ukulele, don't you?" And you lied. You said yes.
Essentially, yeah. I was on my way to play a punk festival in Blackpool, and I got a call from a foreign number, and I thought I'd answer it because it wasn't withheld, you know, it might be interesting. So I picked up the phone. And there was this crazy German guy on the other end of the line. And, "Hello, is this Alexander Gold?" And I went, "Yes, this is she." And he went, "I hear you're a great ukulele player." And
Welsh.
And I bought one about 10 years ago when I was a student in High Wycombe, I think drunk at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a little pink toy one, which I haven't touched for 10 years. I went, "Yeah, of course I am. What do you want to do?"
He picked it up and went, "Ring, tinky, 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 tinky."
He said, "We wanted to join our orchestra for a 2-month tour." So, you know, so I joined the orchestra completely by accident. And I had a month to buy one, a proper one, to learn how to play it, and also to teach myself how to read music.
It's a proper band, isn't it, Alex?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, but to be fair, to give everybody a bit of background, you've kind of played in punk rock groups and various kind of rough assemblies of musicians.
I only thought there were 3 chords in existence.
But this...
How wrong I was.
This was a proper musical endeavour, wasn't it?
Yeah.
How many people?
There's 8 people, 7 ukes and the uke bass, which is basically... it's an Oompa Loompa version of a bass. It's strung the same, it's just tiny.
And a kazookalele.
And a kazookalele, yeah.
Am I right? Yeah.
Yeah, Pockets, who's one of the guys in the orchestra, he invented this instrument, which is a cross between, if you can imagine, a ukulele, a keyboard, and a kazoo. It's astonishing the way he's done it, but it incorporates all 3 of them in the same instrument.
And you're playing big venues, aren't you? Are they 1,500-seaters, or is it 2,000-seaters or something?
I'd say it averages out about 500 people a night.
Oh, 500.
Sometimes it's a little bit less, sometimes it's a lot more.
But that's a lot.
But it's really funny because, I mean, my first 2 gigs this year were in little rock pubs in Amsterdam and Rotterdam, playing to about 50 people, and then 2 weeks later I was playing the Philharmonic in Berlin, you know, with the uke orchestras.
Sold out. You haven't.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm in a hotel room.
It was fascinating to me to kind of keep track of the effect that this was all having on Alex, because, you know, he and I kind of put together the Word in Your Ear gigs, and so we're in regular touch, and so there's Fraser's strange creature.
Digital rabbit's been just...
Digital rabbit, there you go. And so Alex is getting in touch every now and again via Skype from Hanover or Dresden or wherever. And he's giving me progress reports on how it's going. And at one point he actually said to me, I can't believe it. Lots of people come and they really enjoy it.
Yeah.
I'm not used to
you
this.
You don't get that at every punk gig.
And I felt that he was...
Neither part of that
equation. He was speaking on behalf of every kind of... every musician playing in a pub up and down Britain, you know what I mean? Where the band outnumber the audience. This was music as it's supposed to be, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Totally.
It's had a profound effect on you, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's just... It's kind of the dream in a way, because, you know, as you say, you're playing music that people want to hear.
Imagine that.
Give us a quick run for people who are not au fait with your oeuvre. Give us a couple of the songs you play. You sing brilliantly on a Coldplay number.
Yeah,
Viva, I sing Vida. Can't remember that one.
Viva, yes. Vida. Yeah, yeah. I sing that one.
So you're the youth, aren't you?
I'm the youth.
It's a democracy.
You are. You are, because you're kind of cast, aren't you? You're at the young end, aren't you, with the kind of long hair and stuff.
Yeah, everybody's got kind of a character within the group. It's as much a comedy show as it is a musical production, which is a really interesting thing for me, because I've never done that before again. And everybody plays a particular role in the group. The age range is really varied, and the type of people is, you know, really varied. And I'm the youngster, in inverted commas. So, you know, the kind of my sort of running gag is that I'm 13 years old, and, you know, it gets a bit of a laugh in the audience.
I've seen you do that. In this film of you doing that, you sort of say, this song was written 12 years ago, just before I was born.
Yes.
And the place goes mental.
It goes nuts.
It's a broad humour.
And it's great for about a week and a half.
Aching sides. I know.
After 2.5 months, you just want to grow a beard again.
Yeah, yeah.
So to give an idea of the range of stuff, so there you go, you're on tour with the Ukulele Orchestra, you've been to Florida, you've been to all kinds of places. You've been to Alaska.
Alaska.
You were in touch with me. I said, where are you? And it was completely, you know, it was a lottery as to where he was. He said, I'm in Alaska. I thought, you're joking.
But then
to give you a range of the kind of gigs that you did, Alex, that I kept track of. You also once went on your own to Glasgow the morning after the independence referendum in Scotland, where I don't think the good people of Scotland were particularly in the mood
to celebrate. They were not in the mood to celebrate.
For an English musician.
English people playing a bloody uke.
You turned up, you were there to play a gig on your own in a club, yes? Yep. You went by bus. And it was a silent coach, wasn't it, Alex?
I got the Megabus, which I thought was a great idea because it was really cheap. And I had a mate from Argentina staying over, and we got us both tickets. And
so you made him go.
Yeah.
Oh, good God.
Well, I thought it'd be fine because I figured that, you know, this coach takes a long time, so they're going to need to stop. You're going to need some food, and because of that, we skipped breakfast and figured we'd get it somewhere on the way.
You had to wait till Carlisle.
No. We had to wait till Glasgow.
Oh, God.
So they didn't get to eat till Glasgow.
What they do, right? What the Megabus does is it does stop, but it stops to change drivers. They sort of do a little high five.
Then the next one comes on.
So I didn't eat anything for maybe. The bus took 11 hours in the end because there was traffic.
So then he played a gig, Alex. Now, be honest, you are quite candid about this. How many of the good people of Glasgow had turned out to listen to you?
Wow. If we're talking percentages, we'd be into the decimal places, I think.
Preceded by a few noughts.
A healthy amount, a healthy smattering of zeros.
But that's what dedication.
And so having done it, you got on the bus and you came all the way back down to London.
Well,
you?
We stayed at the promoter's mum's.
The glamour, spelled double MA.
So you did that. And then quite recently, you went on tour in the United States with Duncan out of the Boys.
Yep.
Yes?
Yep.
And you played how many cities, how many clubs?
We played 4 shows in 3 cities.
In front of how many people?
Well, let me put this into perspective for you. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love Duncan and, you know, I love playing in his band. But considering we've travelled 4,000 miles, right? There's a photo of a lawnmower taken on the tour. 2 girls on the lawnmower. That got 200% more likes and the total number of people you played in front of.
It's so cruel when it's cold hard statistics, isn't it? Oh, that hurts. Oh, my Lord. Hang on.
God's sake, can I just say
that just before you guys came in, Fraser gone to let you in, actually. I was just sitting in this room on my own, and that rabbit started talking to me, and it said something weird like, could you pass me that thing in front of you? Yes, that thing. And I actually really, it was like something like a candid camera. I'm looking around going, what? What's happening? I'm really recovered.
Have I told you about my bullshit button? I think you gave me actually, okay. Fraser. So I got this bullshit button from Fraser in the office, back when obviously the magazine was still alive, and I'm moving house at the moment. I've, you know, packed everything into boxes and bags, and I was packing everything into my new house in this quiet little suburban street in Forest Hill the other day.
I can see what's going to happen.
And all of a sudden,
you're going to disturb this ancient piece of equipment, and it's going to lurch into life.
It's a mother walking her kid on, you know, to school, and all of a sudden there's, that's bullshit, comes out of the
US. I can remember going on holiday with our kids when they must have been about, I don't know, 11 and 13 or something. They're obsessed with Austin Powers. You remember Austin Powers? You've got these little Austin Powers dolls. We were staying in these little American motels, and you'd get up to go to the loo in the middle of the night, and it always tread on Dr. Evil. And he would go, $1 billion. And if you trod on Austin, he would go, very shagadelic, baby. I can still remember it really well. But a horrible kind of tinny little battery slide running down. Yeah, it was fantastic. Where were we? And you must just tell us about the set. We got, I want a bit more of the set. We've got a Coldplay number. Yeah. We've got, all right, what else do you do? Just some idea, because they just old covers, aren't
they? It's a really varied spectrum, actually. We do everything from, yeah, Coldplay,
you do
Beatles,
Tchaikovsky, don't you?
Do Tchaikovsky, Mozart, Bizet, Queen, some Disney classics.
You do Deutschland Uber Alles.
No, that's the other lot.
There's a rival band. We can't really talk about that, because our learned friends would have to sort of get involved.
But there's everything from classical pieces to, you know, to rock songs to, I mean, it's great as a musician, you know, one that's used to playing in Indian punk bands, because you have to dabble in music you wouldn't even think of touching otherwise, you know, because you think it's just impossible to play, but you've got to find a way to play it.
And so you've got to come out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, totally.
Which is, it's kind of irony,
Billy Jean,
isn't it?
Well.
That's not what punk
Billy
is supposed
Jean.
To be.
They got me moonwalking, and once you've moonwalked in front of 1,000 people,
you
have no fear of everything.
You moonwalk on stage.
Yeah, yeah.
What, did you put on a single white glove?
I bought one, actually.
I was just being facetious. Of course you did.
I bought a toy gorilla as well.
Oh, that's a good gag.
So just to round this off, I want Alex to tell the story of, he got the phone call the other day when he was in the middle of a house move, weren't you? Didn't you? To call you to provide emergency musical services. Go on.
Yeah, so I was... Friday was the big move day, so we're going to move all the significant stuff and get it into a van, which we booked, and shift it over to the new house. I got my day planned out, I got my work schedule set out, and I got my moving schedule set out. And at 10 o'clock in the morning, I got a call from Andy, who I play in the Ukes with, and he plays in a Rolling Stones tribute band.
What are they called?
The Stones.
The Stones?
Yeah, which just works, isn't it? It just works.
I suppose they are, aren't they? The Stones. Yeah. Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Well, it's when you go past my local pub and there's always a yellow fluorescent sign in the window saying, tonight, Elvis Presley, and I'm pretty damn sure that's not him.
No, that's true. But it's usually Fleetwood Back, or is it?
No, they don't bother with that.
Nirvana.
Fred Zeppelin.
No, Fred Zeppelin.
So go on. Anyway, you got a call.
I got a call at 10 o'clock in the morning, just as I was starting to load stuff into the van. And Andy's exact words to me were, mate, Mick Taylor's got the shit. Can you do the gig? And so I had to learn 32 Rolling Stones songs in 2 hours, move house and travel up to Corby in Northamptonshire.
To play the gig.
To
be fair, some of them are quite easy.
Where I played,
you're playing the Mick Taylor, you don't mean the lead part, you must be playing the
I mainly stuck to rhythm, and Keith.
He
kind of handled the lead stuff. But in that venue on a Friday night in swinging Corby, I played to more people than in an entire week in America.
Did you?
Yes.
So what do you open with? What did the Stones tribute group open with? Jumper Jack Flash? Or?
No, we started with some oldies. It wasn't Around and Around. It might have been I Wanna Be Your Man, actually.
Oh, that's good. It started with the first single.
It was pretty much chronological, yeah.
Oh, good grief.
So it started
what the hell
really
did he do when he got to the 90s? Can't imagine what that was like.
No, we cut it off mid-70s.
You see, my theory is I think Alex makes a good Mick Taylor.
Yeah, very good Mick Taylor. That's brilliant.
He's kind of thin and, you know, he's got the hair.
Like the bootleg Beatles, who I've seen a few times, because John Lennon, the bootleg Beatles, used to live by neighbour, used to live in my street, and we used to go and see him all the time. And they not only play the part of the bootleg Beatles, but they also are the Beatles on stage when they talk, they do all that sort of stuff. You know. Yeah. Does your Mick Jagger go, well, all right, and all that or not?
Actually, it's hilarious, because they're all from up north. Two of the lads are from Middlesbrough, Andy's from Nottingham, and the singer, Jagger, is from, he's a Mancunian. And you know, you get there, it's all right, you know what I mean, all right, if they're all right, mate. Yeah.
But when he's on stage, presumably.
And he gets on stage, bang, all of a sudden, oh, and
that's brilliant. The old wagging his elbows like a chicken. That's brilliant. Yeah.
So, Alex, your exposure to this range of music in the last couple of years, have you enjoyed it? It's been good for you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been really good fun. It keeps things fresh and it keeps you moving. It's really easy to get stale, you know. It's something you start doing because you really enjoy it, you know, when you're a child, when you're a teenager. You start it purely for love, and it's easy to get into a kind of routine where you stick to the same stuff, and so it becomes boring, you know.
So yeah. What's your ambition? Do you want to join a Beatles cover band, or do you want to play opera or whatever? He must now think the world's my oyster.
Yeah, I don't know, really. I mean, I guess my ambition is just to keep playing, because that's what I enjoy, and, you know, the greatest thing the last couple of years has taught me, I guess, is that, you know, the best thing is to keep a completely open mind and don't say no to anything.
Yep.
Because you can do it if you lock yourself in a room for long enough. And playing new music's never not fun. So, you know, I've got no real...
Especially if there's actually an audience to watch it.
Especially if there's an actual real audience full of people, you know. It's
ladies and gentlemen, Alex Gold.
Oh, superb.
Thank you. He's going off now to play a gig at the Islington with Piney Gurr. You might catch him if you race down there.
The Word, a way of life.
So the next word in your ear is... did you see what I called it, Mark? We're now calling them word in your era when we're doing decos. Good. Good, isn't it? Oh, word in your era.
See what I did there?
Yeah. Word in your era.
Oh, look at that.
It's all about the 70s, and that's on May the 11th at the Islington with Mick Watts, the great Mick Watts,
yes,
the Melody Maker and so forth, and Johnny Walker, legendary DJ and so forth.
Fun.
So details that you can find on the site. We did one the other night.
Anyone who didn't know what it was, I'm going to present this as a quiz.
All right, okay.
I'm going to read a little paragraph from the drummer of this group's autobiography. And he lists, and I find this kind of stuff absolutely fascinating, he lists 47 songs, I won't read all of them, 47 songs that they had in their set list when the group played on April the 7th in 1974, and if I told you where it was, it would probably give away who the group was, but here's some of the songs they played. All right, Fraser, Blue Suede Shoes.
Hey there, Fraser.
Blue Moon, Wooden Heart, O'Carroll, Save the Last Dance for Me.
Stop, it's Shawaduwadi.
Yeah, yes, All I Have to Do is Dream. Devil in Her Heart, Leaving on a Jet Plane. Proud Mary. It's fascinating. 8 days a Week. This Boy by the Beatles. Very, very difficult song to play. It's a waltz with a three-part harmony. Jailhouse Rock. Hippie Hippie Shake. Long Tall Sally. Johnny Be Good. I Saw Her Standing There. Twist and Shout. Little Queenie, etc. And the answer is... It's only the Jam.
It's the Jam.
Isn't that amazing? And that was in... let me look it up now. That was in 1974. And they were playing the Working Men's Club in Walton Road. And the group, I think, was Rick on drums. I think it would have probably been Bruce playing the bass. Steve on guitar. And Paul Weller, the lead guitar. And it's just, I think it's fascinating.
I think it's fascinating because it was, they weren't a punk rock group at all. They were a jamming band, you know what I mean?
They were
a local covers band,
who
just enjoyed playing and were a bit directionless until the Clash and the Sex Pistols and the Ramones. That's what they talked about.
Yeah, that's
what
Rick
talked about. And they thought, oh, God, now that's an image, and that's something we can kind of get behind, we can identify with. They're round about our age and so forth. And so the punk stuff was just completely invented at the end.
Completely.
To package the thing.
I think that's kind of true of a lot of those groups, because I suppose it really hit me how extraordinary it would have been to see the Sex Pistols, particularly, who didn't really have any kind of precedent.
No, they
pretty much made that up themselves. And there's the rabbit again talking to us in the background. But when the Jam saw them, up to that point, the Jam had been, you know, they were just wearing baggies. They had skipper ties. There's pictures in Rick's book,
yeah.
Which is very good, actually. It's called That's Entertainment, of course, My Life in the Jam by Rick Buckland. And they had skipper ties, they had baggy trousers with little creases in them. Paul Weller, they all have longish hair and big sideburns. And Paul Weller looks like, you know, Steve Marriott, really, doesn't he? And it really struck me that really gave them a sense of direction, didn't it? Because let's just do that. Let's speed up.
Yeah,
let's
yeah.
write our own songs. And we maybe write some political songs, because clearly the Sex Pistols have got some kind of political dimension to them. And that gives us some kind of sense of purpose. They go out and buy their black and white their bowling shoes, American bowling shoes, and their little skinny ties, and they become the Jam. And the other thing that really fascinates me, and which I thought Rick was really good on, very few people are that honest about that era, the punk rock generation, is that he talked about all the groups that he grew up listening to. Because the whole thing about punk rock, we've had this conversation a million times,
yeah.
is that when punk rock happened, groups did not talk about the fact that they love Rory Gallagher.
Yeah.
They didn't talk about Argent, did they? They didn't talk about Wishbone Ash.
No.
They didn't. They talked about Iggy Pop because their managers allowed them to. They talked about Lou Reed and occasionally talked about Van Morrison or Bowie. And that was it.
Yeah.
That was all maybe the Stooges or the MC5. But you were not allowed to talk about. So it's lovely to hear that Rick Buckler, you know, there's a lovely bit where the little drum pattern at the beginning of Tube Station at Midnight is lifted from Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple. I love that. And he talks about buying records by Atomic Rooster and who were the other groups he liked? Iron Butterfly. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Zeppelin, you know. And I love all that. You know, the idea that... And I remember interviewing Adam Ant at the end of The Word, and he was talking about how much he loved Rory Gallagher and Argent, those big things, you know. And it's just something very refreshing about that. Because, of course, they did, Fraser, didn't they?
Yes,
because they all had to listen to records. John Lydon, his absolute favourite group was Van de Graaff Generator, but he was under, really, some kind of restraining order in interviews to never mention any of that stuff.
Because it would
just derail everything they were going to
do. The whole movement of punk, it made you realise how powerful movements are.
Completely.
In lifting. They lift all boats.
Completely.
As the expression goes. You know, it's like Mersey Beat or whatever.
Totally.
You know what I mean? If you get a following wave, you can attach yourself to
it. It's going
to
kill a lot of other people.
You suddenly become quite important.
Completely.
Out of all proportion to your value.
And it also made me think that was a... People think of the 70s as being such a vibrant time. A lot of it really was, but there was a particular desert where people just didn't know what to do. And actually the Jam set list, if you look at it, is 75% pretty much what the Beatles set list was.
Yes.
It's Chuck Berry, and it's things like, you know, it's old ballads, basically, isn't
yep.
it? It's
yep.
standard.
Yep.
And that they loved the Beatles, and so they were kind of doing what the Beatles were doing. But the other thing I was going to say about that podcast, which I do recommend people listen to, because I thought it was really honest, actually.
Because those podcasts are all available on the same
yes.
stream as this podcast.
But I thought it's very touching to hear what he had to say about his relationship with Paul Weller. You know, and I mean, he hadn't spoken to Paul Weller. He hasn't spoken or seen him, actually, since 1980. Was it 83?
83.
So yeah, that's 32.
I've seen him more often.
Yeah. That's 32. Yeah, top 20.
Which is amazing.
Years ago. And, you know, and about the ruthless way that Weller had just, which is often the case with people who are very ambitious and successful, actually, they just, you know, take people on board and then just discard them.
Yeah.
Move on to the next project. And that can relate to their private lives just as much as their professional life. And I thought it was really sweet that he was thinking, well, in a way it'd be terrible to get back together again and ruin the great, you know, legacy that we have. And we kind of said at the end, didn't we? But I tell you, if you rang tomorrow, what do you think? He said, well, you'd have to. And of course he would, because they'd go back. What level would the Jam go back at? They'd go back at an indefinite number of O2s, wouldn't they? 20,000 a night. Whereas when they split up, they played a night at, I think it would be Wembley Arena.
Five Wembley Arenas. And they thought that was excessive.
Yeah.
Really good luck.
So you come back 10 times bigger than you left.
Talking about gig inflation, in my researches for 1971, when Chris Drazier, the former bass player of the Yardbirds,
yeah.
You know, so he kind of knew Jimmy Page and so forth. And he was in New
Actually,
York.
He wasn't the bass player. Samuel Smith was a bit of a go on, anyway.
Okay,
yeah.
Rhythm, possibly.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. And he was in New York in 1971, and he got a call from Jimmy Page saying, yeah, why don't you come and see us? We're playing Madison Square Garden. And Richard thought he'd got the name of the venue wrong, because he thought, bands don't play places that big. You can't have it right. It must be somewhere else. 1971. And Madison Square Garden is now kind of footling. You know, what is it? About 17, 18,000 or something.
Yeah, it's
like,
tiny.
It's probably not even that big.
Cool. I don't even know, actually.
You know, but at the time, you know, bands didn't play venues that big. And so it's just been inflation of numbers all the way along the line. So at the point when the Jam broke up, playing five Wembley arenas was considered unbelievable. Well, nowadays, you get middling bands of probably five Wembley arenas.
Yeah, and anybody coming back, just as the Police found out, you just go on as long as you want.
Carry on
going around the world.
So that's...
It's good. I thought it was good.
That's Rick Bogler, and he was very good. And thanks very much to him for coming. It was absolutely terrific. And we also spoke to Johnny Rogan about his excellent book about Ray Davies, which will also be with you as a podcast. Very soon. We're doing as fast as Fraser can work.
It's a little podcast factory.
We get them out there. So we just thought it'd be a good idea for us to get back together and catch up.
I've almost forgotten what he looked like.
Do you recognise him? Because viewers, you probably don't know this, but David has grown a beard.
And I think it's spectacular.
It's extremely good. I am sick, nauseous with envy. If you gave me a year and a half, I couldn't grow a beard like that.
Well, he looks like a man of the sea.
He does, salty dog. Yeah. He does, actually. Yeah.
I thought I looked rather Shakespearean. I tell people I'm doing it for a film.
Oh, that's good.
Say it's a movie.
Opening at the Donmar Warehouse, if faith.
Because the truth is, I'm growing it because we're having our bathroom replaced. And we went away for a little while at my wife's half term. And I thought, well, I won't shave for a week. I'll get away with it, you know, while they take the sink out. Well, that was 7 weeks ago. And we're still without a bathroom, you know. And the beard is still growing. You understand? Yeah, I'll be like a member of ZZ Top by the time.
That's right.
By the time the bathroom.
Viv Stanchel will be long enough to tie a knot in your beard.
One of the things I wanted to catch up on was, have we all seen, I know it's a few weeks ago now, and it's, you might consider it old news, but I want to talk about it. Have we seen the Tidal launch?
Yes.
The launch of the massive Jay-Z fronted, music streaming initiative, artist owned. Did we all watch that press conference?
Yes.
It's 18 minutes on YouTube, is where I saw it, and it's 18 minutes long. I find it absolutely riveting.
So
let's recommend, for
those who didn't see it,
explain.
Let's go through the names of the artists that one by one were brought on the stage. I think they started with Alicia Keys.
Alicia Keys is the kind of spokesperson, isn't she? And then, who did they have? Jay-Z?
Well, they had
Beyonce, Rihanna, Madonna,
Kanye West.
They had Jack White, two members of the Arcade Fire. Of course, nobody knows the names of the Arcade Fire.
Wim Butler and. And there was a screen, which, of course, had almost inevitably Chris Martin of Coldplay, who could be there.
They had Daft Punk. They had somebody else from Britain, I think.
Dead Mouse.
Okay,
not these from Britain. But also, that
and
was...
And then Madonna, obviously.
Yeah.
And Rihanna.
That's right.
So they're lined up on stage. And, well, what do you think, Mark? What did you think when you saw it?
I thought lots of things, actually. And I was gripped and I was sort of mortified and I felt really sad, actually, watching. I don't know if you did.
Not at all.
You're into it. Yeah. But I tell you, one of the things that really got me was that this whole thing is about the concept of loving music. You know, in fact, I think they described it as an artist-owned music and entertainment platform. So they're setting up their own distribution base.
It's supposed to be like United Artists.
Yeah. And that's fine. Okay, I understand that. But the whole thing was Alicia Keys' pitch, keynote speech, is about how much we love music. Did you hear, David, in those 18 minutes, one single note of music playing? Or did you hear a complete silence? So that was the first thing. When they brought them on, I would have done it like an award show. Ladies and gentlemen, Madonna. And you'd have... And then it's Rihanna.
And the applause is really lukewarm.
And the applause is really lukewarm.
It sounds like there's 25 people.
Yeah. And they all have to stand next to each other looking and feeling awkward. And the other thing, which I used to find so embarrassing when I was a kid, if my parents were ever in the room and I was watching television, when people who were a bit gimmicky on stage came on in their gimmicky costumes, and so you had the combination of Daft Punk dressed as kind of robots, and then Dead Mouse, who just comes on, to be honest, with a sort of mouse's head. He looked like who was that guy who once came with the Wizard? Frank Sidebottom. He looked like Frank Sidebottom with this kind of fiberglass head. So you've got this absurd thing of a load of people standing there, not quite sure why they're there, feeling very awkward, in complete silence.
And then they all
while this guy is trying to talk about, Alicia Keys is trying to talk about how exciting the concept
of
music
changes
is.
Lives.
And the honest truth is, it's not music that's exciting. It's control of music that's exciting. And it's the in the art. They kept saying, somebody at the end, I actually wrote this in a piece of paper, they said, the platform was going to give people quality and great things and great experiences. At no point, David, did anybody explain what the frigging thing was about. Not a clue.
Also,
you felt it was entirely self-interested. It wasn't for the benefit of the audience at all. It was entirely for the benefit of the people making the music. Stopping a load of people sapping their revenues.
You can't turn to the public and say, the poor artists are being ripped off by the streaming services, so let's bring on, one after the other, the richest 20 musicians who have ever lived.
Yeah.
You know, and they are.
Oh, by
these
some
people
margin.
Have made far more money than the Beatles ever made.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? Because the rewards for the tiny number at the top are unbelievable nowadays.
I know.
And all you can... And I'm sorry, most people, and I don't care whether you like them or not, you're sitting there looking at Jay-Z, Jack White, Madonna, whatever, you're thinking the rewards you people have got are out of all proportion to your actual value, to what you've actually contributed.
But it seemed utterly...
You're not that remarkable. You're just really shrewd and really hard-working and terribly ambitious.
Absolutely.
This is just another manifestation of that.
And it seemed completely and utterly transparently self-interested. At no point did anybody once mention a load of groups that we've never heard of, who just need an all-important leg up and give some platform, some international platform. It was really about making sure that, you know, God bless her, that Alicia Keys was not going to have any more of her royalties hemorrhaged away by some bastard sort of...
But you see, one of the things that fascinated me as, you know, as an observer of pop stars when they're all together in any kind of semi-formal capacity, in my experience, they hate it. They don't like mixing. You know what I mean? They like to be clearly separated from the herd, and their status recognised. Once you put them together with loads of other people, they're levelled down, and they don't like it at all. And so they look very miffed. And I think they very quickly, during that presentation, I think 4 minutes into that presentation, possibly earlier, they had realised this is a terrible idea.
There's a great bit where Madonna looks to the side, and just horror on her face when she realises what's going on. Who put me here?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And all
she's already mentally sacking quite a large number of her staff.
Half an hour after that presentation, they were all in 22
different
limousines.
Bitching.
Right. They're kicking the fuck out of whoever had put them in that position.
I know.
Getting on the phone to their agent or whoever. You did what? You didn't tell me she'd be there or whatever. Chris Martin, it's just a shot of him on the VT. And you can see it stealing across his face. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And I'm not even there. So I've got to sit here like I've been, you know, like I'm being interviewed by Jeremy Paxman on Newsnight via, you know, down the line from wherever. It was so awkward.
But there is that some awkwardness that I can really understand, really, which is that, you know, rock stars and, in fact, all celebrities just have made a mental calculation of their own worth. And they think they are bigger than so-and-so and smaller than somebody else. The only rare time was that a real name droppy thing to say? That I went once to a party at the number 10 Downing Street. It's a very terrible thing to say.
No,
but I did.
Awful.
And at the party was Noel Gallagher. I remember Mick Hucknall, Felix Dennis, the publisher, Richard Branson, all sorts of people. And it was one of those occasions where everybody talked to everybody. Because nobody felt that they were bigger than anybody else. You could just tell they were all out. There was a very famous tennis player whose name was going to come to me in a minute. Greg Rozetsky, that's right. And they were all there. But because they were in 10 Downing Street, the concept of 10 Downing Street was just somehow bigger than they were individually. And therefore they all felt they were on some, I'm going to have to say, level playing.
Well,
was not the case there. Because when they brought on Madonna, so she introduced the one more, and she goes, Madonna, you think, well, that's the end of the queue, isn't it? Because she just... It's not.
No.
Madonna
no.
thinks it's the end of the queue. But
looks behind
her,
Rihanna.
Yeah, on comes Rihanna.
Nicki Minaj, I think.
Nicki Minaj.
Nicki Minaj.
I know, and then on comes the bass player of Eddie and the Hot Rods. And so she's really... so everyone's really pissed off. How did that happen?
So, how did they create that list? Who came up with that list?
I don't know, Christ. And who put them in that order?
Weeks of negotiations.
Who put them in that order?
But then they've all got free equity, weren't they? I would imagine that would have been the deal. You get, you know, 3%. All you have to do is turn up. And if it turns out to be really successful, you're
the order in which they come on stage?
Oh, very good question.
I would have thought they'd be thrashed out by teams, phalanxes of lawyers. And
you can say, Madonna,
advisors.
Well, we either do it this way or we do it in age order. Is that all right, Madonna?
Yeah. Or in height, in which case Rihanna would win, of course. Rihanna, that's foot taller than anybody else.
So, well, anyway, well,
that was fascinating.
We're going to be watching the progress of Tidal with great interest, aren't we?
I
don't think it's going to take the world by storm. We may be wrong.
It's just dropped out of the top 700 apps on Apple's iStore.
Oh, Lord. Which doesn't look brilliant.
And they've fired the CEO already.
Oh yes, I saw that. Yeah. CEO's gone. You know, so that's the world of digital music.
The Word Podcast: two cocoa tins and a piece of string.
AC/DC, I'll be honest, are a complete mystery to me.
You've always said that you'd never knowingly heard an
I've AC/DC. Never knowingly heard an AC/DC, yeah. So I've got nothing against them. Bloke in short trousers come from Australia. I kind of get that. Enormously globe girdling popularity. Don't argue with that at all, but strikes me there's queer goings on in the parish of AC/DC.
Well, yes, I
mean, of late, and over to our AC/DC expert.
More specifically,
they made Radio 4 News, so that is quite a big deal.
Oh well,
and obviously day programme.
I think it's business as usual in most of AC/DC, but it's things are going massively awry in the world of Phil Rudd, their drummer.
So give us a bit of a background age of AC/DC.
Well, Phil's 60.
Oh, and they're not as old as I thought.
No, they started young. I mean, Angus was a teenager when they started.
Right. How old's Angus? He must be... He's
in his 50s, I think.
Yeah. God, really? Wow.
But, Phil is the drummer. He lives in Tauranga in New Zealand, which is a very nice part of the world, where he owns a fish restaurant.
Oh, right.
Okay. Last year he was...
Last year I'm surprised at this phrase. You being a Kiwi and a foodie, I would have thought that would had an AC/DC fan.
Got your name on it.
Last year he was fined $70,000 for firing three staff because he'd placed a delivery order, and they'd sent it to his aircraft hangar instead of his boat. So this is the
kind
of
an aircraft.
No, you hate it when that happens.
So this is the kind of world that Phil lives in. He's just basically never had to grow up. You know, he's got mechanical royalties coming in from the second biggest selling album of all time.
Right.
He's never had to grow up. So he's a 60-year-old who's fooling around with young women and doing drugs he shouldn't be doing, and it's finally caught up with him.
Right.
But he was accused of, I think I'm right in saying, what happened was he was unhappy at the events of a launch party for an album. Was that a solo album? And he asked for a former employee to be taken out.
Yes.
Now that's going a bit far.
Well, first of all, before we get to this, the story I first of all read was that unhappy with the launch of his solo album, which I thought was funny enough on its own, you know what I mean? Because Paul McCartney Keith Richards put out a solo album, nobody would buy it. The notion that a drummer of AC/DC would sell a solo album.
It sounds like AC/DC. You may not be surprised to hear that.
Unhappy with the launch party. Launch party for it. He fired a couple of his employees. And I was amazed he had employees. But obviously these are employees at the restaurant.
I guess so, yeah. He also has...
Is he sort of step...
No,
but
later on the story gets...
Yes.
The allegation...
Oh, yeah, it is an allegation.
He's asked for somebody to be rubbed out.
Yes, although that charge has been dropped now. I think he's just been charged with threatening to kill rather than procuring a killer.
Oh, right. So watch this space.
The court date is in June.
Right. And this is hot news at Classic Rock Magazine.
It is hot news at Classic Rock Magazine.
You must have an AC/DC desk down there.
I think we probably do, yes. And
it was hot news at whatever magazine I would have been at. I can't think now. Might have been Mojo or Selector or something. When the drummer of the House Martins, you remember that? Hugh Whittaker?
Oh, yeah.
For assaulting a former business partner with an axe and then setting fire to his house, not once, Fraser, or twice. He did it three times. Maybe he just didn't quite catch fire the first time. He was blowing on the embers. So we should be laughing about it.
He haven't got fire lighters, it's hard.
But he did
three times
on
one evening or three different occasions.
Maybe three different occasions, I think he was. And the other one I remember when I was, in fact, the editor-in-chief of the mighty Kerrang, very, very briefly, there was a group, a Norwegian group called Burzum. And a member of Burzum, or was he called Burzum himself? I can't remember.
Varg Vakein.
That's the guy. He actually did murder.
He did. Yeah.
A rival black metal guitarist called Euronymous. and torched a series of rather beautiful architecturally wooden Norwegian houses. So he's probably still actually in Chokey. He's probably still wearing the crow's foot suit.
I believe he lives in France now.
Oh, is he? He's out. Yeah. He's out of Chokey, is he?
Has anybody ever written a book about crime in rock?
God, what a good idea. Because who started it all? I think who started it all was Sunhouse. Remember? I love Sunhouse.
I met Sunhouse.
How long have I known you? Have you ever told me that?
I think I have, actually.
Jesus Christ, you met Sunhouse?
I met Sunhouse.
Would he come and have a supper or something?
No.
For a dinner party?
I met Sunhouse. It was the very early 70s, and he played at the Commonwealth Centre or something. Somewhere like that. In the west end of London. Went with a friend.
Good God!
He was pretty much past it.
Did he play Death Letter? No, I'm sure.
He was not at his sharpest.
No, he probably wasn't. No,
said hello to him.
Amazing. No, Sunhouse, if I remember right, Sunhouse went to Parchman Farm.
Oh, yes.
In 1927. How many songs had Parchman Farm in the lyric?
Loads.
For shooting. And in fact, killing
or
somebody.
Possibly even just being accused of it.
Yeah, but absolutely. But I think the point was, it was he only got 2 years because it was renegotiated. Actually, that it was or attested anyway that it was self defence. Because what happened was he was playing a gig in a juke joint. Guy came in, didn't like him, shot Sunhouse in the leg, and Sunhouse just pulled out a piece and just polished him off and carried on with the set.
I'm sorry, it's a book, isn't it?
It is a book. You're right, it's a good book. Because the boring stuff is, oh, Keith Richards went to jail in Toronto, or all that kind of drug stuff. Hugh Cornwell, that's very honest.
Yeah, all the phony but stuff. People Johnny Cash.
Lil' Kim, didn't Lil' Kim go to... Johnny, and then Lil' Kim went to jail, didn't you? Are we allowed to say that? We'll check that.
We have done.
If this bit isn't in the podcast, it's because she didn't. I'm pretty sure she did, actually. But anyway, extraordinary.
So, Write that one down. Crime and Rock.
The Word Podcast. It passes the time.
So, we've just had Record Store Day, yep. Fraser. You observed Record Store Day, I generally do, yes. You don't? Do you always?
I know, I always do. I hate Record Store Day, but I still find myself at queuing on Essex Road at 7:30 in the morning.
Oh, so you wake up on Record Store Day in a really bad mood because it's Record Store Day.
Oh, I hate it so much.
But go on, what's the stages of the day? How does it slowly get you into it?
But you're compelled to go along.
I have to go along. The thing that annoys me more is Record Store Day, the Black Friday thing they do, which is the new version of Record Store Day, the second version they do every year. Now, Black Friday in a normal retail environment means you buy a load of stuff in and you sell them cheap. In a record store, you buy limited quantities in and you sell them for more than you normally do. It's completely backwards. And Record Store Day is like that. It's all about money, 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 money. And it annoys me because I want the things they're selling.
What did you buy?
I'm obliged to turn up. I bought a John Grant live album and a White Stripes record.
Was that what was especially done for Record Store Day?
Yes, it was.
Record Shop Day, as I like to call it, big English. Yeah. Record Store Day. How did that happen? God, John Grant live, that's brilliant.
And the soundtrack to the Frank movie.
Yeah. Let's just let the rabbit speak.
Bloody hell, Bruce.
What's it do? So it's on it's like a kind of spin cycle of a washing machine, you know, just when you think it's over, a new program kicks in.
So the John Grant live album, exclusively Record Store Day, surely it'll be out.
It will do, yeah. What they generally do is they release a coloured vinyl version for Record Store Day, which...
Lovely.
You think, oh, that's so desirable. And you
is it very expensive?
It.
See, I don't like colour.
A little more expensive than normal.
Yeah.
I don't like colour.
I like colour.
Oh, I love it. Never got excited about
colour. Oh,
it all seems wrong to me.
Well, the only bad one was the Curved Air album. Do you remember that? Because they didn't get it right. It wasn't actually... It was actually some kind of transfer printed on the top. And it coloured vinyl, obviously, is meant to... You mix it into the vinyl, so it's part of the actual mould. But without wishing to bore people, the Curved Air album, Dave, when you put it on, little bits of kind of dust came off, and eventually, played it three times, it wore the picture away.
That's not right. It's just come to me. Do you remember the colour of... Do you remember the record that was puke coloured?
Yes, what was it called? Yes, go on.
It's just come to me.
Go on.
I think it was called The World's Worst Record, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes,
it was
right.
A compilation done by Kenny Everett.
Yes.
And it had this Pull Over by Jess Conrad, which was always the worst record ever made.
Yes.
And I think, I've got a copy at hand, and I think it's on somebody's idea of vomit-coloured vinyl.
Vomit-coloured vinyl.
That's just come to me.
God, what would that be worth? Probably very little.
But anyway, you succumbed. And how much did you spend?
£165.
Bloody Christ almighty. You know, it's years since I've been in a record shop and spent that amount of money. Do you know what my new policy on buying records is, Fraser? I'll only buy vinyl from the artist.
I like it.
It's a good thing, this. We did a Word in Your Ear not long ago with Ashley Hutchins and Simon formerly of Fairport Convention. And we were sitting in the pub afterwards with Ashley. He's a terribly nice chap. And he just had his prize record came out in the early 80s called By Gloucester Docks. I sat down and wept. And he just somehow got the rights and put it out on vinyl. And he had one copy.
It was really satisfying when I was in the pub.
And he said, I'll give it to you. I said, no, don't give it to me. I will pay you for it. Because I knew it'd be quite a bit. And so it was 20 quid or whatever.
Yeah,
was it 20 quid? Yeah. But to give 20 quid to the artist.
Yeah, that's nice.
It's lovely.
I feel quite good about it.
That's Tidal. That's what Tidal would dream of, really. Yes. The whole point of Tidal is that I get all the profit.
I felt quite good about doing that. Whereas paying that much in a shop, I feel bad about, because I remember the days when you bought that stuff for, you know, 3 quid or whatever, or, you know, even 7 quid when it was expensive. Yeah. And that's just gone mad.
I feel soiled by this experience. I really do.
Hilarious. So while we're talking about records, I wrote a blog recently because my son said to me, "What are you going to do with those records?" And he said this with,
"But not in a kind of, because if they need a home, I'll have them, Daddy." Wasn't in that kind of way.
My son's quite, you know, he's quite rational, you know, and he kind of understands why people get excited about records, but he's not particularly, you know. And like Lodi is 26, and, you know, like all of that generation, not interested in accumulating stuff. They want access to it. That's fine, you know. The object itself doesn't terribly interest them. And so I've got an absolute ton of vinyl at the top of the house, ton of CD and other stuff. And he realises that when I, you know, when I hand him my lunch pail, it's going to be his problem and his sister's, whatever. And so he felt that he ought to broach the subject of what to do with it, you know. And so I don't know what to do with it, really. Years ago, when I first made a will, which must be 30 years ago or whatever, I put a friend of mine as an executor, thinking, you know, he'll know what to do with the records, you know, if I go under a bus or whatever. And but he moved, you know, so he wasn't available and so forth. And so I haven't thought about it ever since. But since then, the records are still there. And in 2015, they're kind of more of a problem than ever before, you know.
But don't you think some of the best bargains you've ever got is when you've gone to record shops, they've done a house sale? Because a lot of time, if somebody, you know, pops their clogs, it's just too, no one knows where to start. So they just call up a record shop and say, come in and give us a flat fee for it. Or often just give them away. And you'll go in there and find someone's entire record collection has just been, you know, turfed out. Actually, there aren't very many shops like that. There used to be just one run.
I think the business has changed. The problem is everybody's got a lot of records nowadays, thinks they're worth a fortune, which they're probably not.
No, they're probably not.
In most cases. The chap that we've frankly sold a lot of records to in our time. I was talking to him once, and he gets called in to do house clearances and so forth, and he's actually been in the room when the children of the deceased are arguing about the price. You know what I mean? He's offered this much money, and somebody goes, "Take it," and somebody else goes, "No, that's not enough."
Oh,
Dad,
Lord.
Dad always insisted
the sirens is here.
That his sensor was worth a fortune. You know? I don't know. What do you do, Fraser?
I made a will. This is rather a ridiculous thing to be talking about. When I made a will, which was about 20 years ago, in order to just really to exercise me into actually doing it, because it seemed rather a gloomy thing to do, I thought I would go through my record collection, find individual records, and leave them to old people. I can remember, and some were things that people really, really wanted, signed by the artist, and some were things that I knew they absolutely loathed. And I must change this will, so I know there's a friend of mine that if I was to turn up my toes tomorrow, that he'd get a knock on the door and someone would be there with a copy of Take That and Party by Take That, and he'd know that Mark Ellen had shuffled off. He would take his hat off immediately and look solemnly
at his joined
feet.
The choir.
I know, but I'll have to go through and update that, really, because you know. But anyway,
why wait until you die? We're not doing it now.
Would you mean go back and rechange the records, you mean?
And give them to the people you're going to give them to.
Oh, that's true. Maybe I could.
Well, exactly. I've got new avenues opened up.
I might outlive them all anyway and they never get them.
Since I tweeted about this, which is always a good way to get feedback, you know, somebody got in touch with me, who I vaguely know, from the British Sound Archive, who said, we might be interested in them. And I thought, ooh, that's interesting.
That is interesting.
Leaving them to the nation.
That's fantastic. Dave, that's brilliant. Now, you'd have to spend like a Sainsbury's suite or something. You could have the Hepworth wing. Be brilliant.
But I'd feel really good about that.
Yeah,
if they ever had any interest in it. And I don't know. Because I said, how do you decide that, you know, you can't possibly take every pile of junk that turns up, you know. And they said, well, it depends. If it's got a particular focus or a particular era or something like that, that might make us interested. And I don't know if mine will qualify or not. But I was quite pleased. At least I thought, I could better imagine doing that
so
than leaving
better.
It to the kids.
Than leaving it to a load of people just going to go and put it up on whatever. eBay anyway. No. You know, exactly.
I assume they take the whole lot and then they go through and they go, don't want that one.
Well, it'd be fine. But at least somebody who's got some kind of sense of value in more than just a monetary value, you know what I mean? Yeah. Interest value or, you know, academic value, or I don't know what.
When you go through your record collection, do you ever have the thought, which I had the other day because I was going looking for a record, and I had this thought about, which rather plagues me actually, and it's things about, there's two sides to this argument. One is records that you listened to when you were a teenager, and you can now really see were a total waste of time. And others are records that were out at the same time that you didn't listen to, and you've only just discovered now, and you wish you'd heard earlier. I know you can't change things because, I mean, you know, the fact that I listen to, I don't know, Atomic Rooster or Principal Edward's Magic Theatre or any of those, or Steam Hammer, or it doesn't really matter because they were just fun at the time. But I call it the Wishbone Ash Judy Sill equation.
So what are you saying?
I did listen to Wishbone Ash, and Dave, I can honestly say, and it hurts me to say it, but I've got to be honest, you know, hand on heart, they just were hopeless. And they were, for about 20 minutes, we all sat there going, Wishbone Ash are brilliant. And then you kind of thought, no, why did we, you know, months of our lives we'll never get back again. We sat in those rooms.
Yeah.
Whereas when I followed, Judy Sill's a really good example, I followed Judy Sill vaguely and listened to her. I remember her on the old Grow Whistle Testing Crossmaker, and she was terrific. And one of my sons, when he came for Christmas, had discovered Judy Sill.
Yeah.
I played Judy Sill all over Christmas. I had rather a warm feeling about seeing my sons back at home anyway, but
yeah.
To hear The Donor being played in the kitchen, you know, I just thought it was fantastic. Went back and pretty much listened to everything she'd done.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's one of those weird things, isn't it? You know, I mean, there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
You can't turn the clock back.
Yeah, yeah.
But you time becomes more and more precious. And you think, did I really sit around listening to, Steve Hammer's first album? You know?
But don't you think it's quite interesting, you see, because Judy Sill, similar vintage and similar fate to Nick Drake.
Yeah, very similar.
And Nick Drake, you know, 1970-71, you were aware of Nick Drake.
Oh, I liked Nick Drake at the time, actually.
Oh, well, okay.
I did like
it. Did you own it?
No, well, I listened
to it. Did you know
anybody heard Thomas Told Me on the Sampler album?
Okay, everybody heard that.
And I had a friend, I lived with a friend who had Five Leaves Left.
Oh, okay. Well, I never did. And so I never had any peer pressure over Nick Drake, similar with Judy Sill. Whereas with those bands, you very often did.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
You all went to see them.
Yeah.
You know, whoever they were, you know, whether it was Little Feat or Steam Hammer or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so there was a great bonding thing with your mates around them, wasn't you?
Yeah.
Wasn't there? Which probably made you overestimate them a bit.
Completely.
Not in Little Feat's
And
case.
Usually what happened is one real enthusiast would lead three or four kind
yeah,
of
yeah,
doubting
yeah.
Thomas's long, who'd stand there with their arms crossed, go, come on, impress me, so-called.
Whereas people didn't get behind.
Actually, quite good.
They didn't get behind Nick Drake and Judy Sill in the same
way. No, and also, to be honest, you know, the information levels were so low that, you know, had Judy Sill, had I even been excited about her, I don't know if I'd even have found out if she was around, or would I have got to London to see her in the tiny little venue she was playing in. I don't really know.
Because she had a terrible, terribly bad luck, didn't she? Terrible.
Jesus, she had a dreadful luck.
She had a terrible accident, didn't she? And I was talking to somebody not long ago, and I don't even remember the name of the guy who'd worked in the record business for years, and he told me years ago, in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, he was in Warner Brothers tape archive in Los Angeles looking something out. And the woman behind the counter had a very bad limp and was getting stuff out. And he realised after a while it was Judy Sill. And she ended up, you know, working in the archive.
I know,
there.
It's so miserable.
Gave the
we're
career.
We're all so she much did bad luck and misery. Terrible. Died a really young,
yeah, 20, yeah,
20, probably awful. The classic 27, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Shocking. But, I mean, you listen to those. Also, what a great musician. They're amazing. I do recommend it. Anybody who doesn't know her, Judy spells it J-U-D-E-E-S-I-L-L.
Yeah, yeah.
And just go to YouTube and listen to things like The Donor or Jesus Was a Crossmaker.
I must go and actually buy those records. Of course, too late to buy them from Judy Sill. But I must say, I don't own those records. I listen to them on Spotify, but I ought to actually
They're really ace.
I imagine they're available on 180-gram colored vinyl.
I'm sure they are now.
£45 at your nearest record store day. I'll be down there.
Queue up with Fraser next year. I can't wait.
The Word Podcast, walking the digital dog since 2007.
So Mark and I are fresh from our recent triumph doing our one-man show at the Larne Festival in Wales. That was fun, wasn't it, Mark?
It's a one-man show done by two people. You see, Fraser?
Get it?
It's a joke.
We played, Fraser, we played the Congregational Church, and we were a bit worried that it wouldn't be full. It was packed.
Great.
It was really good fun. And they
were upstairs, weren't they?
I tell you what I thought was one of the amusing things about it. The Congregational Church in Larne. This is in South Wales, the lovely hometown, in fact, for a while, of the great Dylan Thomas, where his writing shed and his boathouse are. And there's a lovely idea of this kind of low-level village hall theatre, really, where you're not allowed to see the person coming on until they come on, otherwise it will let a little light in on the magic. And so David and myself were stuck behind the projection screen, and the only place you could actually sit, it was a little tiny little triangle. You could probably people could still see your knees and knew you were there.
Yeah.
And there it says, please welcome. And then you walk out. Actually, the same thing happened to me the other day on an even more ludicrous day when I was doing a little thing in Selby promoting my a paperback. And it was the first thing I've ever done on my own. And normally they say, and this is Selby Town Hall, and you know you've got the little bar where you come in and go from there into the main auditorium. And then there's a little dressing room for the artist or the band or the drama, the players, what is it? So you have to go and sit in there from 5 to 7 till 7:30 when they introduce you. And of course, I'm there on my own, and it's just the weirdest feeling. I'm sitting in this little tiny room. It's just, you can imagine it. It's just you, the instant coffee maker, and one of those fridges which you don't dare open in case a fly comes out, you know what I mean? And there's this sort of frosted window, and you can see people walking by on their way to see you, and you don't want to hear what they're saying because you imagine they're saying, who is he anyway? Why are we staying in and watching Vin?
Some reluctant woman being dragged.
Yeah. Who is he?
Oh, I never liked him.
I thought we'd go for a curry.
I always preferred David Hepworth.
I prefer David Hepworth. David Kershaw. He's a good looking one. He knows his stuff on rock. Who's this loser?
Talking of.
Anyway,
sort of
go back to Larne because it's very funny.
Art centres and so forth. The great Al Murray, the comedian. I love
Al Murray.
You've got to follow him on Twitter.
I do follow him. Oh, well,
have you seen his kettle test?
Yeah, yeah.
He travels around it and he plays gigs, you know, yeah, and he'll play art centres, civic centres, those kind of things.
It's a huge place. He does a little selfies with the audience.
Yeah, there'll be 1,000 people. You know, they're decent, they're good size. But he takes a white plastic kettle with him, and he always tries to put it under the tap in the dressing room sink. And of course, the sink's never big enough to get it under. And he always takes a picture of him trying to jam.
The kettle test. Never playing here again.
Yeah, Siren Sister fails the kettle test. You know, it's terrific stuff. But so we're available for for further bookings, aren't we, Mark?
We could. Yeah,
our show is terrific. It's called. Go on.
It's called Complete History of Rock and Roll in 60 Minutes.
60 Minutes. And we did
it every time,
and we got, and it broke out in applause right at the end. I didn't even have to milk it, and it was only later I realised the reason it had done it was it finished on exactly 60 minutes, and it proves my theory that it doesn't matter what the show is, what people are most looking forward to.
Going home.
This is entirely Dave's.
And if you tell people,
it's entirely Dave's engineering here, because I'm not really like that, you know. And I looked at my watch and saw we've got 2 minutes left or something. So I said, well, there it is. And thanks so much for coming. Have we got any questions? Because I love questions. Because you don't know what people are going to ask you. And it's just wonderful.
I don't love them at all.
Oh, I absolutely love them. You know.
No, but
when Dave goes, no time for questions. Thank you. We're going to the pub. And that was it.
And
actually, you're right. Got a good reaction.
You got a really good. Everybody wants everything to be over.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what it is, Bruce Springsteen, I don't care. They want it to be over. Then they got the choice of going away. Probably the questions, and I know exactly what you mean, is half of the audience want to ask questions, the other half want to go away.
No, you're absolutely right. They're fun for the person being asked the questions. You don't know what you're going to be asked. It's exciting, you know.
Yeah,
it's unusual.
Well, you should just say, I'll answer your questions in the bar.
Yeah, anybody
you buy
who
me
wants
a drink.
To stay, that's a good idea. Buy me a drink. pay to play, isn't it?
They're
that's right.
People,
cash
people
for questions. Buy it a pint per inquiry.
But if you, you know, if you've got a local, you know, leisure centre or, you know, venue and you, that you that we think we could pack out. Get in touch.
And a little tiny dressing room we can hover in awkwardly.
We got the taste for it. I'm going to finish here just telling my Bill Wyman anecdote.
Oh, go on.
Because I did a thing with Bill Wyman the other week I was interviewing him for a little film to go with a DVD re-release of it, Salah Records. And I know that this particular bit won't survive the cut. So on the basis that you never throw anything away, you know what I mean? We use every part of the carcass.
Why would he survive it for legal reasons?
No, well, I could tell. You're doing the interview with him about his solo albums. And...
the rabbit's woken up. We're talking about Bill Wyman. Now we've started.
Bill Wyman's solo.
The rest of this podcast has been bollocks.
Because the funny thing is that as soon as you get anywhere near the Rolling Stones, the answers get a lot more interesting, of course, you know what I mean? And he's more interested in talking about them, you know what I mean? There's more to say. There's more drama. And there's a woman there from his management company sitting on the floor, you know, under the camera with a pen and paper. And like I say, she's writing down everything. And any time he talks about Mick, starts writing furiously.
Sure.
I know exactly
what... CC's just squeezing rock stars. You can say what you want.
They're going to say... Yeah. Afterwards, they're going to say to the people making the thing, well, you've got to lose that bit, you've got to lose that, you know. So it's always the interesting thing. Anyway, he told me the story of when Mick and Keith fell out really badly in the 80s. Yes. It said
82 to 87.
So I finished the tour in 82, and they just wouldn't get on. They wouldn't make up. They were both trying to have solo records. Live Aid came in the middle of it and all that. And so when we reformed in 87, we had 5 years off the road. And he said, and that's a very serious business if you're me, Charlie, or Ron, because there's no other income. There is nothing at all. You know what I mean? And you didn't write the songs, so. They go on the tour. It's a huge tour. They're in places they haven't played before. Massive revenue earner. Makes a fortune. You know, finishes, I don't know, 91 or something like that. And then they have a quick meeting. Says we always had a meeting at the end of a tour where we could roughly talk about a time plan about what we might do next. You know, year off, 6 months in the studio, 6 months preparing the promotion, 6 months touring. You know what I mean? Don't do anything for 1993. Whatever. And at the end of the meeting, Bill said, well, count me out because I'm leaving. And they just sort of laughed and then carried on. So anyway, so we'll meet him. Said, no, I'm leaving. And
you joking?
Don't be silly.
You can't. Who would that? Why would you
and
leave?
Actually, somebody said to him, you can't leave. And then sort of didn't go any further, you know. And then when they reconvened, he got the call years later. To come back. He said, no, I left.
I told you. I told you I left. Yes.
And they pretty much said, and this confirms all my theories about bands, that they, even the bloody Rolling Stones, do not communicate at all. And so he said, we thought you were joking. And so he left for about 5 years before the rest of the band realised he'd left.
I can see both sides of that argument, because from Mick and Keith's point of view, who would ever want to leave the Rolling Stones? What a fantastic position to be in. But from Bill Wyman's point of view, there's plenty of reasons to
reasons. He's got to make plans.
Absolutely.
You know, he's got to get on and do whatever he's doing, running his restaurants.
Exactly.
Or whatever, you know, which running his restaurants will have made him quite a lot of money.
Absolutely.
I would imagine, you know. You can't just sit around and wait for the pleasure of Mick and Keith, who may never decide to get together again.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.